Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to the Beauty and the Beast Physical Therapy and Strength and Conditioning Podcast. I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Dr. Ross Childs.
Happy Wednesday, everyone. We'll be Thursday by the time you hear this. Hope everyone has had a wonderful time since our last episode, which has been 2 weeks now. Last week, I forgot to schedule Adam in, so we took the time off. But at least we had some time to come up with a content for today, which we've done in the past. It's going to be about knee pain, so hopefully we'll dive into it a little bit more, and hopefully you'll get something out of it. But how's everything been with you, Adam?
Pretty good, pretty good. A little bit more relaxed, which has been nice. The sun is finally out after two straight weeks of rain, and that has been amazing. I tell people, so right now it's what? Like 70 degrees, probably like 30, 40% humidity, decent breeze.
Hmm.
If there was some way that we could make it so that everything from, 5 miles from the coast inwards was this weather the entire year, and then, I'm all right with winter, but regardless, the entire summer is more so what I meant, and then everything from that 5 mile stretch is, 85 right on the sea, right on the beach, that'd be perfect, because I love this weather. If it could never get any hotter than this here, I'd be fine.
I would probably say that. I enjoy it this time of year. I enjoy summer, so the heat doesn't faze me. And even the fall, again, if I could just keep the daylight year-round, that would be goal number one. If I could get rid of the extreme colds, that would be goal number two. So this winter was not terrible. We had a couple days of extreme cold, but really wasn't that bad, but it also allows us to enjoy this because I didn't just absolutely despise the weather this winter. But this I would say 60s to low 70s light breeze is pretty ideal. Would be a perfect time to just skip out and go golf. But we're here giving content to the listeners. So, all right. So today I wanted to circle back and talk about patellofemoral pain syndrome, which we talked about, we can say years ago at this point. So probably within the first 15 episodes, we probably talked about patellofemoral pain syndrome because it's a very prevalent condition. There's also, as much as we know about it, it's still very tricky to treat. And there are a lot more people this time of year that are calling me up, telling me they have it, emailing me, even depending what you've been doing with your training, you may have been experiencing a little bit of it. But really all patellofemoral pain is if we break down the wording, patellofemoral is just kneecap on thigh bone, and then pain syndrome. So it lets us know that there's a problem. But there is some criteria that we're going to go through. But it makes sense this time of year that people are calling me up more because now we have people hiking, running, and they're just outside more. We're more physically active. And a lot of that has to do with the inactivity that happens during the winter time here. It's like everything that we talk about. You have a tolerance to the task that your body's most accustomed to. And if the wintertime means you're working out less, you become accustomed to working out less. So ground reaction forces will be different. Functional tolerance is going to be different to the task that you're reintegrating after 4 or 5 months. Now, for the members that you work with or your clients, how many of them present with anterior knee pain or patellofemoral pain syndrome?
Right now, probably somewhere in the 40 to 50% range at some point.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, probably. I mean, if we're talking some point is in the last couple of years, probably a higher number than that, but within the last couple of months, I'd probably say somewhere around there, 40 to 50%.
Oh, absolutely. And I'd say everyone who I see at least once in their life has had some knee pain, you know, whether they knew it was anterior knee pain or patellofemoral pain syndrome, or you get the ones that come right out and say, I've had knee pain, I went to the ortho, and they called it patellofemoral pain syndrome. That's such a shitty diagnosis because it tells people what they already know.
Yeah, okay.
You know, why are you here? I have knee pain. Yeah, you have patellofemoral pain syndrome.
Yeah.
It's like, no shit. So I just paid
We're
a diagnosis for all that.
Yeah.
So I guess the benefit to that would be they're ruling out the bad stuff. But it is very prevalent. What we know now about patellofemoral pain syndrome is that you could have 10 different people show up with the same knee pain or presentation, but there's going to be 10 different reasons why. You know, we shouldn't treat it the same way. And what they used to think, you know, in the 90s, for example, very prevalent because there was a lot of research coming out on it, was that there was maltracking or bad tracking of the patella, and we needed to strengthen the VMO. And that was a good theory, you know, and one of the reasons why people like theories is because they're not easily proven or disproven. So you could say anything and just call it the gray theory.
Yeah.
Hey, you can't prove it or disprove it, so right. It must be true. Research got a little bit smarter, and they were able to find, well, you know what? There are some people that have delayed firing in the VMO towards the VL. However, it's all one nerve. So you can't necessarily just turn on the VMO without turning on the VL. We just know from a structural standpoint, the vastus lateralis, or the outside quad muscle, is much bigger. So yes, it's going to start to pull us lateral. And during functional activities, we will see the kneecap move back and forth, but that's why we have muscles on each side. And the VMO really allows the VL to pull the kneecap, but the VMO, or the vastus medialis obliquus, those are the horizontal fibers right near the kneecap, help to maintain a centered position or help to prevent too much lateral tracking. We also know that doing straight leg raises with hip external rotation, there's a force vector in the knee that can target the VMO, but you're not isolating the VMO. So I think you and I can both agree that it's, from a functional standpoint, it's very, very challenging to isolate one muscle. Yes. So especially in weight bearing.
Yeah.
So it, you know, a lot of those things have changed, and then it turned into, okay, now we know if the hip is weak, the knee is going to be weak. If you have ankle instability, that's going to be weak. Core instability, so on and so forth. So they started to get into classification schemes. And the reason they come up with these classification schemes in physical therapy is so that we can better direct treatment. So they've broken it down into a couple of different categories. And I was just looking at prevalence factors, but we can also talk about risk factors as well later on. So once you get to the classification scheme, you know, I'm just going to read them off and I'm going to see, you know, if you agree with them, if you've seen those classifications that they lumped people in, and then what your thoughts are as far as the members that you work with, what you've seen, and then we'll kind of talk about how to bring it all back together and then how our members can basically diagnose themselves. And I'm saying that in air quotes, and then we can certainly get them into their own treatment program so that they can be better suited for the activities that follow. So the first classification that they came up with is patellofemoral pain with overuse without other impairments.
Okay.
So it's just repetitive stress. The second one is patellofemoral pain syndrome with muscle performance deficits.
So weakness.
Weakness.
Okay.
Patellofemoral pain syndrome with movement coordination deficits. So stability control issues. And then patellofemoral pain syndrome with pure mobility impairments.
Is that like a hard block?
Yes. Okay. So more joint, which probably could be coming from the knee, the hip, the patellofemoral joint, somewhere else in the area. Let's see. They also talk about tissue irritability, but just based off of those classifications, with the people you've worked with, have you seen those four classifications?
Yes, definitely the first three more prevalent than the fourth. Well, I mean, granted, I can't diagnose the fourth, you know what I mean? So you never know, but definitely the first three. Most people that I've worked with have some measure of all of them. You know, some people are stronger but not as stable. Some people are more stable but not as strong. But like I don't know that I've ever had anybody that is severely skewed in one of those directions but not the other.
Yeah, exactly. So it's nice that they broke it down that way, but I think we need to remember with these classification criterias, you can be in a couple of them, but there can be more of a preference of one over the other. Because I'd say most of the people that I see are the overuse overload, probably followed by movement coordination, and then probably muscle performance would be last. Because a lot of people we see are active to begin with,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of them will say, well, I hike, and I bike, and I work out 17 times a week, and I do this, and I do that. And it's like, well, you're not doing much to really offset that stress, and eventually it builds up. I'd say there have been a couple times I've seen anterior knee pain from a loss of ankle dorsiflexion.
Mm-hmm.
So typically when squatting, you know, they end up shifting their weight too far forward to get around dorsiflexion, close off the knee angle, and ouch, there's my pain. Or they'll get a pinch behind their knee. But technically that's not going to end up causing patellofemoral pain syndrome. Now, for the people that have come in and you were thinking, all right, it's patellofemoral potentially from overload,
mm-hmm.
overuse. What's your first thought as far as training's concerned? Should they keep overloading it, or is that a chance where it's like, you're already overloading it, let's kind of change paths?
So if it's somebody that I know is doing like the things required to help keep the to keep everything in a good spot, so they're rolling, they're stretching, they're, you know, hydrating, they're not trying to eat 400 calories a day, if they're doing the things that I know are going to help keep them healthy, mm-hmm. then I'm more liable to, you know, maybe back off the reps, maybe change it up and do something that's a little less, you know, like rather than doing your basic split squat, maybe working like a TRX split squat or a like an eccentric split squat, taking the concentric portion, the standing up part out, mm-hmm. whatever. Depending on the person, I sometimes have to get a little bit more specialized with it. But I'm more liable to change the actual movement that causes it. If it's somebody that I know is having knee pain, or let's say like they, you know, oh, I'm having my knee hurts today, but it hasn't really been a problem for the last couple weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Then my first thing is like, okay, roll it. Let's do some extra rolling, some extra stretching. Does that make it better? If it makes it better, then okay, we need to focus on that a little bit more, you know, and kind of manage it that way. If you run 5 miles 3 times a week and you do that for 3 weeks, and on the fourth week your knee starts to hurt, and
pretty big giveaway.
Well, right, yeah, exactly. And if your knee starts to hurt on Monday and you're planning on running on Wednesday, and Wednesday morning you take, you know, an extra, let's say 10 minutes, whatever, 10, 15 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and you really overload the stretching and the rolling, and then you go out and you can run 5 miles, and maybe it starts to be a little sore at like the end of the run, but for the most of it, it's fine, then okay, we know that we probably need to keep an eye on it, because
mm-hmm.
at the same time, if you have to continually keep increasing your warm-up in order to be able to output the same amount of effort, then we know that you're going in the wrong direction, but we can tailor it a little bit more.
Yep. So you kind of went right down the you basically went down the same path that they were talking about in the classification criteria. So I just pulled up this decision tree that they have, you know, that eccentric stuff. So day one, you know, generally the eccentric stuff will cause that pain initially.
Mm-hmm.
Now, does that mean it's the worst for us? No, but you talked about reducing volume, which reduces load, which they talked about load magnitude as being something that can be a diagnostic factor in all this. Because we have to remember there can be other knee conditions that are not patellofemoral pain syndrome. We have to rule out Sindling-Larsen syndrome, which is basically a traction apophysitis at the bottom of the kneecap. Osgood-Slaughter, which is at the tibial tuberosity. Could be patellar tendonitis, could be retro patellar fat pad atrophy, whatever they call it nowadays. Could be quad tendonitis. And you could have a bunch of these all mm-hmm. played together. Now, if you're suspecting... Or let's go with the classification. If someone comes in patellofemoral and you're suspecting a movement coordination deficit, what would you anticipate in your head? What would you say? This is what I would expect to find.
I would expect to find that their balance isn't fantastic. And by balance, I just mean like if I told somebody to stand on one leg,
yeah.
that they're going to be unstable, maybe not on both sides, but most likely on whatever knee they have pain with,
mm-hmm.
they're probably going to have a little bit more trouble balancing than the other side. And if there's a massive difference, then that's a really big sign that's probably major reason for it.
Sure. And with that massive difference, so a large deficit, what compensation do we typically see in those with knee problems?
Usually valgus, the knee tracking inwards.
So those are the two biggest things in the criteria for movement coordination.
Sweet.
Yeah, so you're spot on. You could have been a PT.
Dope.
You just don't want the debt. all right. So now if someone comes in, patellofemoral pain syndrome with muscle performance deficits, what muscles do you think are going to be weak?
So muscle performance, or are we talking stability?
Performance. So so strength.
Okay. So what's going to be weak? More often than not, glutes, lateral glutes. I guess that's more stability based, but
no, that's fine. Glutes and lateral glutes are the two first ones they have.
Glutes, lateral glutes, maybe quads, but
what else?
Hamstring possibly.
Boom. Yep, they listed all four of those. Okay, nice job. So it says that typically with those with muscle performance tests, generally we're going to see. It says here 37% of males and 30% of females typically will have deficits in their glute med, their lateral glutes, 13-17% deficits in some of the smaller rotators, which can be the glute med as well, piriformis, and generally a 30% deficit in glute strength in males and females. That's pretty significant.
That is pretty significant. I'm not surprised, but that is significant. That's
30% is huge.
Yeah.
And I think you and I talked before. I think it was actually me, you, and Dylan, and I did a video for this on, I think it was my Instagram page, best exercises for glute strengthening, and the step-up exercise being one of the better exercises that we can do, because we're getting, as long as we're maintaining a neutral leg position, so meaning that it's not going into valgus, we're not overshooting it in external rotation, everything is working the same, but we're going to work our lateral glute med specifically, and we're also going to be working the glute max because we get hip extension when it comes underneath us. It's also saying that 44% of males with thigh strength testing will typically see the knee extensors be weak.
Interesting.
Yeah. Females, 37%, and then knee flexors, it doesn't give a percentage. So that's pretty dang significant.
Yeah.
So 44% decrease in quad strength in those with patellofemoral pain syndrome. So, you know, that's a lot where we wouldn't need stretching. Foam rolling's probably not going to help them out that much. This is a case where, okay, we need concentric, we need eccentric, we need isometric. This person needs volume, mm-hmm. but appropriate volume. So you can kind of see, just talking about those first
technique
three.
Volume.
Exactly. Those first three, we have the spectrum of, all right, we need to reduce volume. Eccentric loading's okay, but we need to put the fire out, and then we can build you up. Coordination, we need to make sure that you can control movement first, then we can load you up. And with this one, they're saying, okay, you don't have an overuse injury. You're just a little bit weaker than we'd like to see, so we purposely have to load you up. But eventually, we get to that point where we have no choice. We have to load you. And then performance mobility impairments. Again, you said that you didn't necessarily diagnose, but I'm going to read off what they looked at and just tell me if you've seen it before in individuals that you worked with. So this one says that people typically can have hypermobility in their midfoot. So pronation. Have you seen that before with those with knee pain?
A little bit.
Yeah, because that pronation can actually cause a knee valgus. Patellar tilting of the lateral patellar, so meaning that the kneecap is tilting to the outside.
I haven't seen a ton of that, not personally.
Yeah, unless you feel it, you probably wouldn't notice it anyways, or if someone's laying on their back. I've seen it far too many times to count at this point, so not uncommon. Hamstring tightness, so typically they lay on their back, you do a straight leg raise, and it's going to be less than 79 degrees. How often do you see that?
Of the ones you've mentioned so far, that is by far and away the most common one.
Correct.
That I've seen.
Yep, and a typical compensation with that is that when they start to raise their leg up, their knee starts to flex.
Mm-hmm.
So they try to shorten it to take away some of the tension. Ankle dorsiflexion of less than 10 degrees.
I mean, limited ankle dorsiflexion, yes. The degrees, I'm not 100% sure, but that is more common than I would have I used to realize, I guess is a better way to put it.
Yep. So with ankle dorsiflexion, and I've checked it on you on the table, and we talked about normal range of motion, non-weight bearing should be 20 degrees. Functionally, people can get up to 50 degrees because it's now the leg bone moving on the foot bone compared to the other way around. And they've shown that those with weight-bearing ankle dorsiflexion of less than 37 degrees can correlate with knee pain.
Okay.
non-weight bearing, or from a walking standpoint, I should say, we do need a minimum of 10 degrees to bring our toes up away from the ground so we don't scrape them. Yep, that's why we need. That's why I always look for a minimum of 10. So this saying, you know, those with less than 10 are at an increased likelihood with ankle dorsiflexion. So we'd assume there that if we don't have proper dorsiflexion here, then that's going to create more patellofemoral forces right at the kneecap. Then it also says, this is one I've seen, actually, ankle dorsiflexion. So with your knee flex, less than 14.8 degrees. I usually tell people we should hit 15. So that's more for me, not you. Quadriceps. How far, if I'm laying on my stomach, how far should I be able to bring my heel towards my butt as far as a knee angle is concerned?
I mean, theoretically, you should be able to bring your heel pretty much all the way to your butt.
Yeah, about 134 degrees of knee bending. So unless you watch people on their stomach bend all the way up, we know that coming up vertical towards the ceiling is 90, so we need to go well beyond that. There's a lot of people, especially with back pain, have tight quads.
Mm-hmm.
But this says less than 134.
Okay.
That's probably what's causing some of my knee pain, because my right leg is much tighter. And I can force my knee there, but that's 134 is a lot. This one says Ober's test at 90, so that's just testing IT band tightness. So this says less than 11 degrees. And then hip ER and IR range motion testing. 35 degrees with external rotation, minimum of 25 internal and external rotation. So again, some of the things with a goniometer you wouldn't necessarily test, but functionally you'd probably be able to see. Look at someone and say, that really doesn't look that good. So I think this gives us a nice framework that we can work with, because I think we can at least teach people how to manage their own pain. So for example, let's say someone goes to the gym, they decide to do probably a lunge, for example. That's probably going to be a better suited exercise, because I don't know too many people that do step downs at a regular commercial gym. I would anticipate that on the way down, they feel pain. I think we can both agree with that. Now, how do we decide if a lunge position is more overload versus a coordination deficit?
I mean, I would say take the balance out of the equation.
Correct. So
TRX, something that gives you some support.
Exactly. So if they do TRX or they hold on to something and all of a sudden the knee pain gets better, it's a stability problem. So if that cleans it up, great. We know we just have to really control the motion. Whereas if we do an eccentric lunge, we hold on to something and it doesn't improve it, that's probably more of an overload.
Yep.
Now, if we're going in that same, we'll use the same exercise, how would we determine if it's a muscle performance deficit, so strength problem?
So if it gets no better when they're holding on to something, or if the knee pain only presents at above a certain weight that they're lifting, if they can do a goblet split squat with 30 pounds, but as soon as they start getting over 40, they start having pain. Something along those lines.
Yeah, I would absolutely say, because it's not necessarily the eccentric portion and the concentric would potentially be problematic in those with a strength deficit.
Yeah.
Even with an isometric, it would probably be painful. They just don't have the strength to control it. And then, of course, with the mobility impairment, let's say it's an ankle dorsiflexion problem. We want to stay with the lunge. What could they easily do to determine if it's coming from the ankle or not?
So what could they do? I would say, as soon as the ankle stops moving, if you start having pain then it's probably an ankle problem.
Yeah. Or what I would do is take a 5-pound plate.
Oh, right. Duh. Elevate your heels.
Elevate the heel. And all of a sudden, my knee pain goes away. Yeah. Well, that lets you know your calf muscles are too tight or the joint's not actually moving. So I think those are very easy things that people can look for in themselves, because this is not... They rule out all the other bad stuff to get to here. And people always want x-rays. There are times that we should get x-rays done. If there's really no mechanism of injury and you have relatively full range of motion, don't get an x-ray.
Yeah.
If there's been a mechanism of injury, an acute mechanism of injury, then there's some criteria that we can look at, and it's called the Ottawa Knee Rules. And it determines whether we need a radiograph or not. So when someone calls me and they say, I fell on my knee, the first thing I ask is, can you walk at least 4 steps? Yes. Okay, that lowers the likelihood that you need an x-ray. Because the criteria is going to be pain on the fibular head, pain on the inferior and superior poles of patella, tibial condyles, and then inability to walk 4 steps immediately following.
Okay.
So if you can do all of those, you don't need an x-ray. You know, it's going to be sore, but you're probably still going to be able to limp. So non-weight bearing, can't sustain any pressure on it, go get an x-ray. That'll be fine. So once we've ruled that out, now it's a matter of, okay, Osgood Slaughter's, for example, usually only occurs in younger children or younger adults. I mean, you can start to develop it as young as 8 or 9. 10 to 12 is pretty typical. It's when puberty starts. It's usually when the muscles are pulling up on the bone and then the bone is replaced.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got it on both sides. Yeah, and it's just very, very hard now to kneel on hard surfaces, so I feel old when I got to stand back up. But functionally, it does nothing now to me.
Yeah.
It's just if it gets hit, it fucking kills. And like I said, all the other kind of tendonitis-type syndromes. You know, but again, even if there's a meniscus problem, generally there's been some type of injury that occurred.
Right.
You know, a chronic meniscus tear that keeps pulling is slightly different, but what would you expect to hear if someone actually tore a meniscus? What's kind of the, what do they usually report prior to feeling the pain?
Traumatic.
Yeah.
Injury of some kind. Their foot planted and they twisted over the top of it. They jumped and they landed straight legged. There's usually an event. You don't just sit on the couch and then wake up the next morning with a meniscus tear.
The mechanism of injury fits.
Right, right.
So we know that. Same thing with any ligament damage in the knee. The mechanism would fit. You know, someone says, oh, I was playing flag football, I planted my leg to cut, and I felt a pop.
Yeah.
There's a pretty damn good chance you just tore your ACL. You know, someone says, oh, I was playing football, someone tackled me, hit the side of my knee, and I felt a pop. It's like, all right, you probably tore the ACL, the MCL, and you probably tore the meniscus.
Yeah.
So, again, the mechanism has to fit. So, hopefully, this just gives everyone an idea of when they need an x-ray, does the potential mechanism of injury fit? And then if it's not, all right, you know, we've excluded or ruled out all these other conditions. It's not significant. Now, based on these criteria, I can use X, Y, or Z to get better. Now, exercise-wise, because this is the important part for most people, with the classification of overuse and overload, we talked about reducing volume. You mentioned use less weight, less reps. How else could we reduce overall load on the knee?
So, reducing overall load, you can do assisted variations like we talked about, TRXs, whatever. You could do tempo type stuff where you're increasing the length of time the muscle is under tension, but not necessarily increasing the overall load on the tissue. Let's see.
Are you a fan of reducing the overall range of motion?
I mean, if you can go through a range of motion with the pain staying roughly the same or decreasing with the decrease in weight, then yes. If somebody gets below, I'm just going to use 90 degrees on a squat. I believe you should, if you can physically squat below 90 degrees, you should squat below 90 degrees. So I'm not using that as a steadfast rule, but just as something that people
are arbitrary number.
Vision. Yeah. If they can squat to 90 degrees and then they go below 90 degrees and they have pain, and they can't get rid of, like, you know, maybe it's their warm-up set and it doesn't go away after a couple sets, or they do some extra foam rolling, some extra stretching, and it still doesn't go away, then, okay, fine. Maybe decrease range of motion for that training session.
Yeah.
And then repeat the process next time.
Yeah, test the waters when you can.
Yeah.
So typically the way that it works for me, I don't usually load people when they're in here. But I'll say, okay, this is the technique I want to use. If you choose to use weight at home, go ahead. And I'll just use the lunge because we were talking about it. So it would typically be, okay, try full range of motion with this weight, with the technique that we tried. If that's still bothering you, I want you to lower the weight, but keep the same technique, same range of motion. If that still bothers you, I want you to get rid of the weight, try full range of motion with the technique. And then if that still bothers you, that's when I reduce the range. If that still bothers them, that's when I typically go to the assisted stuff like the TRX.
Yeah.
So I think the, and I tell students this at Franklin Pierce, I say, you know, you can really tell the good PTs versus the incomplete ones. And I think we can say the same for trainers and strength coaches. The ones that have the experience, the ones that are not limited by their creativity, they have the ability to change on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone, if there's pain, you can change it to make it easier. If someone says this is not hard enough, well, you know what? Let's do it this way instead. And I think a lot of that is lost because so many people just want to get spoon-fed exercises.
Yeah.
And I think the general public is the same way. They just go online, they get a program, they learn the exercise, but if it doesn't work for them, they either force it or they abandon it. There's no in between. I also feel orthopedic medicine is the same way. Squatting hurts, so don't do it. Terrible. Because then we lose our squatting pattern.
Mm-hmm.
You know? What if someone has to sleep on the second floor and they say, oh, stairs hurts. Are you going to tell them don't do stairs?
Right. Here's the number for the guy that installs the chair elevator.
Yeah.
Or whatever that thing's called.
Yeah, it's like, you know what? Just have your spouse carry you. Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, it's like, don't worry. I'll have my 7-year-old carry me up the stairs. It's fine. He probably could at this point, but...
not ideal, though.
No, not ideal. I mean, because he dropped me on purpose, but... All right. So I want to stay kind of with that same theme, moving down with those who have control issues.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of your favorite exercises if someone has knee valgus? So the knees like to cave in.
So, I mean, band work is usually my first start. If I have somebody that, and I've gotten away from this a tiny bit because you also can go too far the other direction, but I'm not going to go on that tangent.
Yep.
But, so putting like a TheraBand, you know, just below the knees to reinforce pushing out. I'll do that sometimes or have done that with people with split squats. If their knee is caving in, the same thing. Like you attach a band to a rack or to a wall or whatever, something that's at knee height, and step into the band so that knee is, they have to actively work against the band pulling them to help kind of just fire that up to get that feeling of what it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Other like cues, just, you know, knee between your big toe and your pinky toe. Don't let it go outside your big toe or outside your pinky toe, or, you know, things like that.
Yeah. A lot of those are the cues I try to do without the bands first.
Yeah.
You know, and then I like to see, can they do it without that? I don't want to call it reinforcement because it's not reinforcement, but feedback. Because sometimes you're not trying to purposely cause them to fail. What you're trying to do is give them feedback so they have reflexive stabilization.
Right.
Essentially, the band throws them in. Can the body restabilize by pushing out? I do like it with, or let me say, I can justify doing it with any of the athletes, but I think those who have a very hard time, the low level, or people with a low tolerance, I should say. Sometimes they need that feedback, and just a little bit of resistance goes a far way. But those are typically secondary to, okay, now we're doing a step up. Don't let the leg cave in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and just giving them that cue and that cue only. And then I can start to work on, okay, now we need to make sure your hip is coming up over. We're going to make sure you're not swinging the leg up over the box. You know, all those different things. So... I try not to make it too confusing to them, but I definitely prefer weight-bearing exercises.
Absolutely.
In this case, with the exception of like standing hip abduction, because at least I'm getting control on one side while strengthening the other.
Right.
Even if it's resisted. So that's one of those exercises where I could say the mobility or the performance deficits and the control deficits go hand in hand. So that's where we start to see some of the carryover. Now, if someone has the strength deficits, what are some of your favorite exercises? So again, we don't necessarily have to worry about pain because our goal is strengthening them. What are some of your favorite quad dominant exercises?
Split squats.
Split squats. So on the internet, there's terminology things that we should probably go over. For the longest time, we called split squats static lunges.
Okay.
So yeah. To me, they're the same thing. I know now that it's actually a split squat. So for those who are not familiar with what a split squat actually is, it is basically a static lunge. It's just that a lunge is supposed to be an actual stepping motion. So you may hear both, but for the sake of this conversation, we're going to call it a split squat. Now, why do you like the split squat?
Because it requires more control and can be varied up in a lot of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
So like a goblet squat, you can, you know, if you're working with a professional that's watching you, you could theoretically get away from the side that has a mobility restriction. You can lean, you know, if your right side is more limited, doesn't have as much strength, whatever it may be, you could be leaning slightly to your left and not realize it.
Yep.
Assuming that you're not working with a trainer or a PT that's watching you.
Yep.
A split squat, realistically, you can set yourself up in a bunch of different ways that can tell you what's happening without even having to look at it. You can have somebody put their foot halfway underneath the bench and say, touch your knee to the bench each time on the way down. So like, you know, the knee is going forward. It's not going in. It's not going out. You could put somebody next to a wall and say, you know, keep your knee as close to the wall as possible. Don't let it cave in.
Yep.
Just assuming that just saying, you know, don't let the knee cave in or push the knee out doesn't work. There's so many different ways that you can do it while still having to work on some measure of stability within the joint.
Yeah, absolutely. Same question for hamstring. What are your favorite hamstring dominant exercises?
In terms of functional movement and that kind of thing, I really like hamstring curls. Val slide hamstring curls, something like that. TRX hamstring curls. In terms of strength, RDLs. Any sort of deadlift, really. I know that those we're really looking for more glute strength a little bit on some of those, but
yeah, you're still getting secondary hip extension activation by way of the hamstring, so I think those are perfectly fine. Now, just with RDL real quick, do you like people to learn an RDL with both legs on the ground, or do you typically jump to a single leg RDL?
I usually like, well, I wasn't expecting you to ask me that. So they're looking for all-out hamstring strength, I'd say both feet down. If they're looking to improve their stability, then it would be a single-leg RDL.
Correct. I was hoping you would say, it depends, because that's the most common answer I give. But you answered that perfectly, because you really have to understand why you're using it. So, and this is a huge thing that I see with PTs. It's a huge thing that I see with students. Oftentimes they just give exercises without being able to justify it, which a cookie cutter approach is not the worst thing in the world, but eventually it's going to have its limitations and pitfalls. So you answered that perfectly. That just shows experience right there.
It's funny. My first ever like job in the field, I had worked under a guy who was a little bit of a strict guy, you know, the kind of guy, very like stone-faced, very whatever. And I always remember, he's always in the back of my mind, like, because he told me day three, day four, I don't care necessarily what you give somebody for an exercise, but if I ask you why you gave them that exercise, you damn well better be able to back it up. And that's always kind of stuck in my head. Like, you have to know why you're giving somebody an exercise. If you're just giving somebody an exercise just to make them feel like shit, then you're missing the point.
They're wasting money.
Yep, yes.
They can just Google.
Yep.
I mean, that's the biggest thing. I tend to give people single leg deadlifts a lot.
Yeah.
And that's mostly for control of the knee. So this is a case where I'll typically pair it. If I've given them something like a split squat, I don't want to necessarily come back and give a pure strength exercise for the posterior chain. Maybe I'll do something that's a little more control related. Mm-hmm. Or I could do something the other way around where it was mostly a strength RDL, and then I could follow that up with, you know, maybe even a quad isometric instead of having them go through. But it's just I'm trying to not put them to the overload group now. So I'm reducing load that way. What are your thoughts on glute bridges as far as the hamstring is concerned?
As far as the hamstring is concerned, I believe it's your goal shouldn't be necessarily to build your hamstrings using a glute bridge. To me, the glute bridge is, I mean, it's the name implies glute first. Hamstrings are an accessory muscle that are supposed to help control the knee, control the hip, but they're not supposed to, like, you should not only feel your hamstrings on a glute bridge.
And what's the most common thing that we'll see in a bridge if someone's hamstrings are acting both primarily at the hip and the knee?
Cramping.
Oh, instantly.
Instant.
They'll just either instantly grab the back of their leg,
yep,
or they'll kick the leg out. Ah, I'm getting a cramp. It means your glutes aren't working.
I remember I'm sorry, I'll stop reminiscing here in a second.
No, please.
It's just funny. I remember the first ever seminar I went to was the Perform Better seminar. It was Martin Rooney. It was Boyle. I think it was Nick. Oh, my God. Who's the really good Q guy? He works at, he founded Exos. I can't think of his last name. Nick Winkleman. Oh. Maybe he's not Exos, but Nick Winkleman.
Okay.
And then, I don't remember who the fourth. Dan John was the fourth one. But regardless, we went and we did a... there was a hands-on practical with Boyle. And I remember my hamstring cramped, and one of the guys from Boyle's gym was walking by, pointed at me, went, shitty glutes. And kept walking because my hamstring cramped when we were doing bridges.
Sounds like me when I'm talking to the students.
I know, right?
Just walk by, say something, and walk off. Let them figure it out.
Right.
Yeah, that's terrible. And then walk off. Dan John, that's old school strength,
yeah,
right there.
Yep.
Big guy, too.
Yep. He's a monster.
Yeah, he is. Good speaker, too. Good, yep, author. I always enjoyed reading this stuff. I thought you, at first when you said Nick, I thought you were talking about Nick Tuminello.
Tuminello, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what kept popping in my head, but I'm like, no, that's not
I was
going to
say it,
one.
And I'm like, Exos. That I don't remember, because Exos, isn't that Verstegen's place?
Maybe. Maybe I'm confusing the two. For some reason, I thought Exos was Nick Winkleman, but now that I'm saying it out loud, I don't think it is.
Well, because Exos, they have one in Florida, I believe. They have one in Phoenix. I think they have a couple of them. They do a lot of football.
I was going to say, they
training,
do a lot of football.
Which I think it was originally called Athletes Performance or Athletic Performance.
I wouldn't be surprised, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that's Verstegen, who I think at one time, him and, I don't know how true this is, I heard that him and Boyle were good friends, mm-hmm, and kind of went in separate directions. So I don't know if that's still the case. Again, it's something I heard. Again, someone probably played telephone, and by the time it got to
right,
me, you know, they're probably the worst enemies in the world, so... now with mobility impairment, so our fourth classification, and we don't have to go too far down the rabbit hole with this one only because it's a lot of this stuff I do manual therapy for, but again, when we're trying to teach people to do it for themselves, if you're suspecting someone has too much foot pronation,
mm-hmm,
what are some cues that you like to give to have them increase foot stability?
Grip the ground with your toes. Pretend like you're digging your toes into the sand.
Yeah.
Create a little bit more of an arch. Tripod foot.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure your heels, your heel and like your each point of the front of your foot is touching.
Yeah.
More often than not, the dig your toes into the sand often works pretty. I usually don't have to go too much past that one. If it's somebody that's in like a cloud shoe, sometimes it's as simple as taking them out of the shoe.
Take that goddamn thing off.
Yeah.
I'll usually tell them
6-inch sole.
Yeah. I'll usually tell them swivel your foot into the ground.
Oh, that's it. Yep. Corkscrew.
Yep. And outwards or counterclockwise. Counterclockwise on the left, clockwise on the right. And that typically pulls the knee to a neutral position, by way of the hip external rotator. So yes, it's a stability problem all the way at the hip, but that typically helps with midfoot mobility. Now, what if someone has tight hamstrings? So what can people do? What do you think, in your opinion, is the best hamstring exercise, and that doesn't necessarily mean strength, to help with hamstrings that are too short?
Either glute strengthening or eccentric hamstring work.
Yeah, I like eccentric hamstring work. This is also a case where I'm not against hamstring stretching.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm not really against ham. Yeah.
Because there's a known deficit. So I'm okay with it. I don't like the sit and reach because most people bypass it with their spine.
Yeah, it's all spine.
I don't like the bending over and touching your toes. I prefer more of like a seated hamstring stretch. And then that way you can use a hip hinge to stretch it out. So nothing that's super aggressive. I know some people are against stretching altogether. That's completely their prerogative. I've seen too many benefits from it to not do it. I can't promise it increases performance, but I also can't promise it decreases performance.
Right.
So might as well do it until the research tells me something different. What do you like to do for those who have tight ankles? What do you typically prescribe to them?
First and foremost, mash the shit out of their calves with a lacrosse ball or a foam roller, depending on where they're at. And then ankle mobility drills. So like foot flat on the floor, drive your knee towards your toes. Just come back out of it. Drive the knee forward, come back out of it. Drive the knee forward, come back out of it. Those two tend to work wonders for me.
Mm-hmm.
Either that or, a more emphasis on loading it when they're on that angle when they're loading.
Yeah.
An elevated, a step up can be a good way to like really overemphasize getting the knee forward to get strength while keeping the heel down. Elevated split squats, so where the front foot's slightly elevated so you can drive slightly forward.
Yep.
Things along those lines. But usually my go-to is mash the hell out of it with a cross ball and then actually work the ankle joint itself.
Correct. That's the one I typically give. And I'm also not against traditional ankle stretching or calf stretching. I just don't want to see any pinching in the front of the ankle, like ankle impingement.
Mm-hmm.
So if they do have it, that's when we need to back off, and I either do the self-mobilization like you described, or you're just going to mash and bash the tissue.
Yeah.
So there is a time and a place for calf stretching, just like hamstring stretching. Now, the last two that they have listed here, or actually, the IT band and the hip external rotators, I typically treat the same way, and I'll just jump in on this because I feel very passionate about how I don't really feel like the IT bands are ever tight. It's usually from the hip musculature that makes up the IT band. And then if we have repeated knee bending, it's going to make it lengthen down below. So unless someone has true IT band syndrome, where it's the IT band right on what we would call the lateral femoral condyle, then most of it's coming from much higher up, more proximal factors. There's no great way to stretch out the IT band, but a little bit of foam rolling to the IT band or using the lacrosse ball. But then for the hip, I usually will do like a pigeon stretch or a 90-90 stretch, or I believe they're called pinwheels here.
Yeah, that's just what we call it, yeah.
Yeah, so I think that works well for a lot of people, especially if someone has really, really shitty hip external rotation. Just getting that tissue to glide. But that's also a case where I'd go through my system of, okay, we got to loosen it up first. Now let's teach the joint to move that way. Good, now let's take that increased range of motion and put it into use. Is there anything different that you would use if you suspected someone had a tight IT band or you just knew they had shitty hip mobility?
No, those are the big ones. The pinwheels, the pigeon stretches, foam rolling the glute to the lateral hip.
Yeah.
I mean, those are my three big go-tos. That's what I do. That's what I give everybody first.
Do you ever do a lot of or teach people how to do the banded mobilizations or banded mobility work? Like you strap a band around the squat rig or the squat rack and then wrap it around a joint and do like banded
some
distractions.
Like, kind
and
of
stuff
like distractions.
That.
Yeah, I did a lot of that when my back was all effed up. That stuff's awesome, but usually I haven't had to go to that length for a lot of people. Most people, the foam rolling, the pigeon, the pinwheel, like your general stuff tends to make a pretty big difference. But yes, I have done some of that stuff before for sure.
Yeah, I like it a lot. I think sometimes people are just limited because they don't have a space tank or the bands, or they don't have the bands themselves.
Yeah.
And I don't want someone to have to go buy that equipment if they don't currently have it. But if they have it at the gym, or if they have it... or if you do have it at home with a place to anchor it, I think they're great options.
Oh,
and
yeah,
it's a great way to either do it on off days or to add it in as a part of a overall warm-up. Quad stretching. This is often something that I feel gets butchered. Do you prescribe quad stretching? And if you do, what's your preferred quad stretch?
So my preferred, yes. So yes, the answer is yes, I do. I like to, like we everything we talk about, I like to have them hit it with a lacrosse ball if I'm feeling especially torturous.
Extra mean.
Yeah, or a foam roller first. But then after that, a half-kneeling hip flexor stretch or a quad stretch or a couch stretch.
So could you describe the couch stretch?
Yep, so basically you have one knee down, the other foot's in front of you, and the back foot is either... They call it a couch stretch because your back foot would be up on... Or I've always assumed that that's why they call it this. I've called it something different. But because your back foot would be up on something so that you can sit back towards it to increase the stretch on the quad. So like let's say that you're kneeling down in front of a couch. You put your back foot up on the couch, your knees on the ground, and you stretch that way. A half-kneeling quad or hip flexor stretch is the same thing, just instead of the foot being elevated on something, it's just straight back from your knee on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find that there are some people that cannot sustain the knee compression?
Yes.
So I love the couch stretch. I love the idea of it. And it's a very effective stretch. But I know for me, there are times that I can't tolerate that compression. I always have to have one pillow underneath my knee.
I was going to say, whenever I have to do it, I have to have something on my knee.
And then if I'm here, personally, I have to use the AirX pad.
Yeah.
I need something a little more dense than that, or two pillows at home. So typically what I do is I call it a modified couch stretch, where I'll use something higher like a countertop or a table or an arm of a couch, just so I'm upright and mm-hmm. I don't have my knee on the ground. So it's... Think of it kind of like the old runner stretch where they would just pull their heel to their butt.
Yep.
But now my foot is anchored to that table. And I think that's, for most of us, myself included, is far more efficient.
Yeah.
The issue I'm finding is a lot of people go into an anterior pelvic tilt. So I always have to stress that once you get into that position, before the stretch is even felt, anterior pelvic tilt. So if we're doing it correctly, that does a posterior rotation, which is now going to lengthen the proximal quad. So it's pre-stretching. And then from there, there's usually a gap between your heel and your butt. And then I usually will tell people, try to lean your body as one unit towards your heel. If they feel it right above the knee, like in the tendon, you're not ready for stretching. Go back to foam rolling. If you feel it in the midsection of the quad, just deep breathe at that point.
Yeah.
You know, make sure that you're getting an efficient stretch. Well, the relaxation piece for a lot of people is hard.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
A lot of people use, not inappropriate, but improper breathing patterns. And it's the ability to relax. It's the ability to decrease perceived stretch in a given position. So deep breathing for me, I think it's far more efficient compared to looking at a time or a time constraint goal. Because 20 to 30 seconds is the average time that we'll hear. It's kind of the common one. It's like three sets of eight in the gym. People mm-hmm. just say, stretch for 20 to 30 seconds, you'll be fine. But if someone's not paying attention or they may be holding their breath or shortchanging it, you don't reduce tone in a muscle that way. So to stimulate your rest or digest response, we have to have a full inhalation by a full exhalation. So we have to remember respiration is subconscious, breathing is conscious, mm-hmm. and we have to be aware of that. So I think that's a missing piece for a lot of people when they try to do a lot of kind of this restorative stuff that we talk about with foam rolling and stretching. it's that conscious control of their breathing definitely can be the missing piece for that. So, all right, so we went over the classification systems. We talked about ways that people could kind of semi-diagnose themselves at home. We talked about exercises that we thought would be most appropriate to them. Is there anything else that you were hoping that we'd touch upon? Patellofemoral, anything that's just a burning desire to get out?
No, I think it just is helpful to close with the fact that, I mean, like, unless you have anything to go with after this, which go for it, but that just because you feel pain on certain movements doesn't mean that you should stop using the joint. It's what we always talk about. When I go to the gym, my first, unless I'm like just really loose that day, pretty much anything knee dominant, the first one to two sets are almost always somewhere on a scale of 3 to 4 on the pain scale. And you know, I've adjusted that. So now when I do something that's heavy quad dominant, or knee dominant, whatever, it's usually paired with some sort of mobility exercise to help loosen it the rest of the way. And that's even after my warm up, you know, my foam rolling, my stretching, that sort of stuff. So try not to get, if you go through 5 sets and it hurts every single set, then okay, something needs to change.
Let's go ahead and back off.
But just because you have pain doesn't necessarily mean that you shouldn't do some version of it.
Correct. I mean, we've talked about before, my rule is if you warm up and it feels better, great, keep going.
Yep.
If you warm up and it doesn't feel better, don't avoid it, but that's probably not the day that you're going to push it.
Right.
Because you need to be careful. And I'd say probably my closing remarks to this is, you know, unless there's a known mechanism of injury, oftentimes the knee is the victim and it's not the problem. So we can't just blame the knee for it, although most of us, it's, oh, my knee hurts, I'm going to go get it checked out. Okay, if they do an x-ray, they're going to find something. You look hard enough, you'll find something. Yeah. So we just need to remember that it's not always the problem. And we also want to recognize that a well-developed program is going to help to address the overload issue. It's going to help address stability and control issues. We're going to make sure that we strengthen the quad and the hamstrings and the hip muscles. And we're also hopefully giving the appropriate mobility or stretching exercises to improve those impairments. So at the end of the day, you know, especially if someone's working with you, you're helping them to identify that and you're able to build that program for them. And if someone comes here to see me, I've identified kind of which classification that they're in first, give them the best plan of care, and either what happens is they don't need me, or we find other deficits that lean them towards a different deficit, and then we start to work on that. So again, this is not meant to be an all-exhaustive list, and you, the listeners, are not supposed to be patellofemoral pain experts just because you listen to this. But just understand that there are many different avenues that we can go, and not all is lost if you have front of the knee pain, especially when you're in a loaded position and so stair climbing, squatting, things along those lines. And there are many different avenues that we can try before, you know, we have to take more extreme measures. So with that said, that brings this to a close. We'll put all the information at the bottom of the show like we normally do. If you guys have any questions, comments, concerns, ideas for show, feel free to reach out to us. But until then, we'll see you next week.
All right, later guys.
Take care.